Welcome to CYC Podcast, Discussions in Child and Youth Care, episode number 110. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. Today is the last of our presentations from the Ontario Association of Child and Youth Care Conference, which took place in June of 2017. This week is the final keynote by Teresa Fraser, with some help by Eric and Julie, who Teresa will introduce in due time. I hope you enjoy the presentation.
This place is really rooted in our child and youth care history. One, because the grounds were previously the Lakeshore Psychiatric Hospital. And in my early 20s, actually I was carrying my first child, I was the head of a community board called It's Our Lakeshore. And it was the resident community's decision to consult the government on how we were going to use the lands for the Lakeshore Psychiatric Hospital. So Humber College was one of those many items on the list, and then ended up being the thing that the community wanted. So, and I think the grounds reflect that when we not only have a community college here, but we have cultural spaces here. There's a building that was set up for children who experienced abuse to come and talk and have interviews with the police in a safe way instead of a police station. Volta was here, which was affiliated with Thistletown Regional Center. And when I was in my first year of training, I really wanted a placement at Thistletown and I didn't get it. And I was determined I was going to get there because I knew that was our birthplace. So I contacted them and said, I want to volunteer for the summer. And they said, okay. And what a rich experience that was, because there were some kids who had some pretty interesting challenges that also lived in residence but came down to Volta. And about my fourth week in, we went swimming at the Lakeshore swimming pool, which is just a couple blocks north of here. And they said, oh, can you take him back? He's got a driver picking him up. So I brought him back, and the staff were aghast that they let a 19-year-old volunteer bring this kid over. But what they didn't know is it took us double the time, because every tree we passed, he had to hug and kiss. Because that was just what he did, so I did too. So on the way we were back, yeah. He taught me about that. But what you may not also know is that we've heard through the Truth and Reconciliation meetings and the press, and we know a lot more of what we don't know, and we know we need to learn a lot more. But children were treated in all of those schools in horrific, abusive ways. And in addition to that, we wiped out cultures, we wiped out language, we wiped out ways of knowing. And we're dealing with that now, over seven generations later. In addition to that, not very far from here was the first boys' industrial school. And it opened in 1893 and didn't close till 1929. And the boys that were held in that school were the boys that eventually ended up in Orillia and Penetang and the Lakeshore Psychiatric Hospital. And then there was a second group of kids, anyone that was developmentally delayed and the parents couldn't manage them. Then there were the kids that were created lots of havoc in the justice system even then. And this is just as the Children's Aid Society was coming online in Toronto. But that institution was alive and well, and there was about 300 kids that were in that institution. They wore uniforms, they were schooled there, they marched down Lakeshore Boulevard to various churches in New Toronto. And it finally closed in 1929 because the staff that were there that weren't child and youth care trained, obviously, because our profession wasn't formally even started, it was mostly guards and a matron. And the kids experienced a lot of abuse and neglect again. And then right after that closed, they opened up another school in Brockville and moved kids to Brockville. But girls, they opened up the Grand River Institute for Girls in Cambridge. And again, same patterns of care of treatment. So I use the word care because at the time, the belief was that they were providing care. And yet they created children who knew what abuse and neglect was. And then those children parent their children accordingly. And then the cycle continues. So the buildings may still stand in some of those places, but the stories and the ancestors continue. And that's one of the biggest things we have facing our career today. And it also coincides with Sue Pratt and another author, her name escapes me, Sue Pratt, who was at Mohawk College for many years and was very involved in our association. They wrote a wonderful article around the history of child and youth care. And many students know that article in their first year. I did some more research around their paperwork, but other pieces that were written, and interviewed some folks. So Jane Clifton, I said last night, my first integrative seminar teacher was at the gala. What an amazing woman she is. And Grace Nosbalken was another professor here at Humber who was really instrumental in my formation of identity as a CYC, as well as Pat Ferbiak. So Pat Ferbiak and Grace both trained, and Jane were at Thistletown, and then came into the college. But what my research showed up that I hadn't read anywhere else before was that, we know Warrendale. How many students have seen Warrendale in their classes, the movie?
Yeah,
raise your hand. So I just want a couple words from you. When you saw that movie, what'd you think? Yell it up there.
Ridiculous.
Why? I can't see you, so just say whatever.
Just the type of treatment and way that we thought we'd work from when we started.
Yeah. Like, are you talking about the restraints that happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other negative things that came to mind from that movie? Restraints? Questions? So after I watched that movie, I'd seen it early in my career, and then we showed it in a class I taught, and I thought, wow, I wonder what happened to those people. And I was lucky enough to track down the woman child and youth worker that did the bedtime wake-ups, and she's 70-something, retired in Victoria. And I tracked her down and said, I want to talk to you about Warrendale. And she said, why? I said, because I only saw a bit, and my sense is there's more to the story, and I'd just like to hear the story. So what she talked to me about was that Warrendale movie. Alan King, the director, created that movie, and it was, the parts that would get a reaction were the parts that you saw. So she said, yes, there were kids that were restrained, and yes, we engaged other children in restraining other kids. Thank goodness we don't do that today. It's horrific. But at the time, they thought they were providing good care. And while they were, she said, what you didn't show was the hours that led up to things before the restraint happened. And you also saw in the movie, you know, how everybody came together when the house mothers had a death in her, she died, remember? And then they had a funeral at Thistletown and the kids were there. And she said, and they talked a little bit about how not only do we have to have supervision, but our own psychotherapy. And you didn't realize that when we worked, we were really working 12-hour days. So we would get there in the morning, do wake-ups, and we were the same people that put the kids to bed. And so it went. And in our field, that's what it was for a lot of years. So you'll hear old-timers talk about in the frontline days. And I'm adding myself in that club right now because when I talk about 12-hour shifts and, you know, some of the things we did, students go, really? Like, 12-hour shifts, and why would you have to do that? And you did it for, like, when I moved, after my second job, I moved to Alberta, and I got hired at a mental health treatment center where I met Jack. And they offered to pay me $19,000. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm rich! Wow! Because in Ontario, I made more two nights a week and a Saturday as a cashier at Dominion than I did frontline in my position. And in my current position, when we got a new associate dean and he started talking about salaries with us, and I said, well, you gotta understand, like, most of our graduates are gonna be making maybe $15, $16 an hour. And he said, why would they do that? That was the question. And I said, and that's a really good question, isn't it? Why would they do that? So I wanna ask you, why do you do this? One word, shout it out. Why? Why would you go to school for 3 or 4 years or more and start out working contract jobs without benefits, maybe not such a great salary? Why are you doing that?
Elicit change.
Elicit change. I want to hear something else from someone else.
Young people. Make a difference in someone's life.
Make a difference in someone's life. Say that again.
Equity?
A voice.
Oh, a voice. Thank you. To provide a voice for them.
Because they matter.
Connection.
Fun. Compassion.
Hope. Inspiration.
Love. There's that L word. Love. And what was the next one?
Inspiration.
Absolutely. So we do all of these things for all of those reasons, but we also do it for us, right?
Because as I talked about last night, one person can make the difference between a child suiciding, hurting themselves, hurting someone else, giving up, deciding that they're not worthy, and not being able to go forward. And we make that difference. The challenge is that you may not hear from the youth we work with about the difference that you make in their life. They may be the child that targets you and swears at you all the time and is in conflict with you. Or they may say thank you, but a lot of times we don't even need that thank you, right? But when you have a youth come back and say to you, you know, at the time, I know we were, I probably made you feel like you weren't doing anything that was meaningful or helping me, but you changed my life. Because we're planting seeds, and we may not see what happens with those seeds. But we also, as a profession, have the responsibility to plant seeds with each other. So we need to hold each other accountable when our concept of care isn't what we think it should be. That's the only reason things have changed in the province. It was when I moved to Edmonton, I just remember it so vividly. I worked in a residence where, yes, restraints did happen here, and I moved to a treatment center, and it was 3 staff, 8 kids, cottage model like Thistletown, 2 groups of kids, and we were having dinner. And old timers are always saying, you know how your shift's gonna go by how dinner goes. You always know how things are gonna go. And in this particular place, I'm having dinner, I was like on shift maybe 3 hours, and a youth swore at the person who is the head staff for the night, and all of a sudden 2 staff are restraining this kid on the ground. And he looked up at me and he said, what, they don't teach you how to restrain in Ontario? And I said, no, we just wait for chairs to fly first. And they went, oh. And I realized really quickly that the standard of care and the pattern of care became the culture in where you work and in how you were educated. So how we were educated initially was, it was by need. So children initially were in those industrial schools, then they could move to jails, then they might be in hospitals, and then, you know, Thistletown came around and Warrendale came around. And when they opened up those programs, they decided, hey, we need to train some of our own people. And the core, so I found some of the original curriculum, which I'm really geeky about that kind of research, and it was really like, wow, that's exciting. And when I found that for that first kind of training material, it was interesting because it wasn't unlike what we're teaching today. So they had about, the first program was one day a month for 6 months, and then the next program was a couple days for 16 weeks. And then they would have follow-up training as they went and supervision. And it would be courses on things like, believe it or not, neurobiology. Yeah, so we're talking in the 60s. Neurobiology, the impact of medication, the DSM, how to do wake-ups and bedtime routines, you know, basic needs of kids. And then eventually, it became clear that we needed to have, the program was so successful according to the standards of the day that the education then moved to the community colleges. And this was before there were any university programs, right? So it was just the colleges. And when the colleges started to do their, well, first I'm going to tell you what the role was. So the role was defined, we're talking in the 60s, as, and it's not unlike today, child care workers is what we were called, carry out these tasks through the use of relationships, play, group activities, rules and routines, rewards and consequences, but not punishment, limits and control, and techniques for controlling behavior. So the words would change now. Under the new certification domains, we would say behavior. Anybody know? Guidance. So we're guiding versus controlling. And then eventually it moved to the colleges, and then the colleges were, everyone realized, well, you know, we're not all consistent in all our curriculum, so we need to have some consistency. So they came up with a word called DACOM. That's a word some of you recognize, eh? So, and there was 11 things we had to learn. To organize and administer, to parent, to program activities, to counsel. So we're talking like 60s, 70s, right? To teach and supervise clients, to work with parents and families, to identify needs and develop groups, to work with and in communities, to develop personally and professionally. So it speaks to supervision, right? And a responsibility to the community. So we've changed, we've adapted in some places, but some of those core CYC values still remain in terms of our code of ethics and in terms of our programming and in terms of the direction of where we want to go. But we know we even with our good intentions and to do all of the things that you were able to yell out and in showing care, that we drop the ball sometimes, right? And that our profession is still emerging. And it's only going to emerge if we intentionally and authentically engage in supervision, not only with our supervisors, but with each other. And we consult with the elders of our profession. And we ensure that we have diversity because we're working with kids that are experts in their own cultures, faiths, community groups. And they and their families can tell us what they need and what we should be doing to be supportive, not to fix, not to change, not to colonize, but to support healing within and resiliency. And we need to look at ourselves in terms of what we haven't done so well, both at the college level in terms of how we educate and in the field. And we know with all of the press that's happened around the horrible things that have happened to youth in care, that changes have to happen. In one of our workshops yesterday, there was a student, I'm not sure if you're here, and we talked about, I said, if you had a magic wand, what would you like to do? And he jokingly said, I'd like to blow up the system. And we kind of all nodded and went, yeah, we feel like that sometimes too. But sometimes it's easier to do the work from within than from outside. So that means we all have the responsibility of joining together as a community. And this conference, like no other I've ever been in at any conference in any country, has been such a testament to community. It started with Richard and what's this, the other girl's name that sang? Yeah, singing us in. And then Heather talking about, this is, you know, where I was and this is where I'm at and we're on this journey together, but I'm going to show you instead of telling you. And then workshops that don't not only include the elders, but the young people and the students, because everyone has to have a voice to make change, and we all are bringing something uniquely to the field that no one else in this room can bring to someone else. And we need to make that commitment to each other that the conversations continue, not just at a conference. And we do that by joining together as a CYC family. And that means being a member, and it means encouraging everybody else to be a member, and engaging in activities, and engaging in thoughtful discussion, and putting proposals in for future conferences. We have never had so many students put proposals forward. And the comments that I got from attendees and colleagues that went to those workshops were, wow, that was a fantastic learning experience. Which, like, yeah. And then I want to ask the amplifiers in the room again, can you please stand up? So, and then I'm going to ask the people now that want to be amplifiers to please stand up. So you are also the voice from this community to take back to your communities to say, hey, they want to hear from you. We want to know what you have to say. So we're entrusting you with that task. Please do that. So in terms of, you know, what is a child and youth worker, I talked about the definition. And I know what I think a child and youth care practitioner is. And I, from talking with all of you, I've had a sense of what you think it is. But we've invited a youth here today that often speaks at the college I'm privileged to teach at, Sheridan College, to come and talk about what he thinks it is. So if you could join us. Are you there? Oh, here we are.
Your shoelace. Eric, you've had a child and youth care worker, eh?
Yeah.
How many years have you had a child and youth
care?
15 years?
Yeah.
Can you think of one of the most significant things that stood out for you that occurred when you were chilling with a child and youth care practitioner?
I think I can. So one of the biggest things to me that any CYC has ever done for me is I have dyslexia. If any of you don't know what that means, I see stuff, I don't know left from right, basically. So tying my shoes, one of the most difficult things, because the first thing everybody tells you is, oh, it's right, then left, then under. What? Which one's which? And then they try and explain it, and it's, I don't get it. So my entire life, I ran away from it. It was always, oh, hey, tie your shoe, and I was gone. Gone. Like, they never caught me. So, in grade 6, I was about 12 years old. So the self-consciousness of being having to wear the Velcro shoes while everybody else has those new lace shoes and knows exactly what they're doing, it's probably a really difficult thing for me. I try to, like, forget about it, but, like, it always comes back. So then one day, a CYC who wasn't there for me, she was there for another student, and that was what she was there for. She had to, like, hang out with him. She knew I didn't know how to, well, she didn't know, but she could tell I couldn't do it because I ran away. So then one day, it was lunchtime, and I was trying to get out of the school, go outside so nobody would be like, tie your shoe. So then she was finally like, you don't know how to tie your shoe, do you? I was like, yeah, I totally do. Don't worry, I can do it. And she's like, no, I know you can't. So you're not going outside until you can tie your shoe. And at first I'm like, oh, great. It's going to be another one of those long speeches of left, then right. And I'd be sitting there not knowing what she's saying. So she tried that and immediately realized it wasn't working. And then finally went, let's think of it a different way. And I was like, there's no other way to think about it. It's left and right. I'm not going to be able to do it. And then instead she said, try and connect the loops. And I was like, okay. So I went, and I did it. And it was like the first time I ever did it, so I was really proud. And I didn't want to untie that shoe. I was like, can I go now? I did it. Can I leave? Like, I did it. Can I go? And then she's like, no, you're going to untie it. You're going to do it again. I was like, okay. Untied my shoe. And I sat there for 15 minutes going, I'm not going to do this. I'm done. And then I was like, okay, let's give it one more try. I tried it again, and I got it. And she's like, okay, now untie the other shoe. I was like, oh, great, because that's the shoe that never comes undone. So I undid it, and again, I sat there going, okay, I did it twice, but I still can't do it again. It's not going to happen. And then again, I was like, okay, let's try it, and I got it. And then finally, she was like, so after doing this, what's the biggest thing it showed you? And I was like, tying your shoes doesn't take left to right? And she's like, well, yeah, but what else? And then I was like, I can't run away from problems. No matter what happens, you can't run away from a problem because it's gonna always come back. So I use that every day. And if I could go back and see her and be like, this is what you taught me and this is what it's done for me, that'd be great, but I can't. So instead, I help other kids. Like, if they're in math and they don't know how to do multiplication, I don't really either, but I'll still go over there and be like, hey, have you tried this? Of course, they give you that look like, no, it won't work. I'm like, just try it. And they're like, okay. And then it works. And they're like, oh, wow. I'm like, yeah. So, like, I guess just being able to do that and know that just because one person told me to, like, showed me how to tie my shoes instead of giving me the speech of left, right, just showed me that even though in life everything will affect you, there's always a problem. Nothing will always go right. If you just try and go through it instead of just standing there being like, oh, great, there's a wall in front of me. Instead of going, hey, that wall might have a door, and going through it.
Yeah. Can I ask you, are you planning to talk about the thing that happened recently to you? With Dylan?
Oh.
Before he goes on to one other story, Eric mentioned that he had a child and youth care practitioner in his life, his entire life. When Eric and I tell this story, the punchline comes out because he said that he had an amazing mother who tried over and over and over to teach him to tie his shoes. She happens to be sitting behind me.
Okay, so another big thing that's happened. This is more recent, not tying my shoes. In fact, it's not, well, it's kind of shoe related. But I skateboard. And it's a big thing to me because even though I couldn't tie my shoe, I still had that thing where I could be like, oh yeah, well, I can't tie my shoe, but can you do this? And I'd pull out a skateboard and I'd do something that I didn't even know I was doing. Sort of just happened and then be like, ha, can you do that? And people would be like, oh no, I can't. And they'll be like, ha. So then, recently, one of my mom's students, his name's Dylan, he came over and he was there just to watch us one night.
He's a graduate first.
Though. Yeah, he graduated.
About boundaries. Yeah.
So he came, yeah. So he came over and, of course, being the teenager I am, I was like, oh great, a babysitter. This will be fun. So then I grabbed my skateboard and I went outside. I was like, I'll just ignore it for the whole night and I'll be out here skateboarding. And then he came out and he's like, oh, you skateboard? I was like, oh great, he's trying to shoot a conversation with me. Yeah. And he's like, oh, can I try something? I was like, okay. And in my head I was like, oh, he's gonna hurt himself. And then he goes and he actually like did a bunch of tricks. And I was like, whoa, wait, what? And then he's like, yeah, I was a professional skateboarder. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. And he's like, yeah, but I hurt my knee, so I can't do it anymore. And I was like, oh. So then we just kept talking and talking. And then eventually he's like, he wanted to start a skateboarding school for kids to teach them how to skateboard. But see, the big thing about it was to give them something they could do in their life and an area where they didn't have to worry about everything else. So then, I've always been thinking about that, and it keeps going through my head all the time of, what can I do something like that? And then I was like, okay, let's go with skateboarding. And then I realized, in my area, we don't have a skate shop. So I was like, okay, what do I do about that? And then a city council guy actually came into our school. And then he was like, we want to hear from you. Like, what issues do you guys see? I was like, oh, I'll tell him and let's see what happens. The next day I get an email back from five other people going like, hey, we hear you have the enthusiasm to actually run a skate shop. How would you feel about it? And I was like, well, I'm broke. First of all, won't be able to pay for it. And they were like, oh, we're running this program. And I was like, oh, and like you sign up. And you give us a business plan and like why you're doing it. And then if you get it, we'll give you the money to help you start it. So I signed up and I went through all of that. And then, so my idea, it's called the mobile skate shop. So the way it works is I have my backpack and my skateboard and I go in between all the parks and I help fix people's skateboards. And everybody's like, oh yeah, you're fixing skateboards. That's great. But then to me, it's like, I'm fixing their skateboard so they don't have to go home and then have to deal with whatever they have to deal with. So I'm there instead of them having to come to me and being like, oh, I need this part. Instead, I'm going to them and going, I have the part. Like, here you go. And I recently found out I actually got accepted into that program. Thanks. So then, as we're going through it, they said you needed a mentor. Oh no, there's no skate shops in Brampton. Who's going to be my mentor? So of course, the first thing that my mom said was, let's email Dylan. I was like, okay. So we emailed Dylan, and he actually was like, I'll help you with it, and I bet I know somebody who will be your mentor. So I haven't gone through with that yet, but it was big to me to show that even though he did what he had to do, he still came back and was like, even though I've done what I had to do, I want to do more. I want to help you in the next step of your life instead of just being like, yeah, I was there.
What Eric told me before we came in here was that the confidence to be an entrepreneur, to start his own business, started with learning how to tie his shoes in grade 6.
Thank you. So, in that story, there's more than just tying shoes, right? It's like the characteristics of the relationships we have with youth. We're going to stick in with them. We're going to meet them where they're at. We're going to look at what their strengths are, and we're going to build on those strengths, and then we're going to maintain connection. And you didn't just like win. You won like $1,500 to $3,000. Like that's all. And how old were the other people in the grant meeting that you went to? Yeah, I think you're the youngest grant member. I think I have to co-sign. I'm kind of scared about that. No, I'm not. No, it'll be fine. So I asked Eric to come here today because he tells that story at every open house at Sheridan College, whether I'm there or not. It's like, they don't, to be honest, they're like, is Eric coming? It's not, are you coming, but is Eric coming? And his guide with him is Julie Jaglitz. Can we give her a hand? Thanks. And Julie is the coordinator of the Child and Youth Care Program at Sheridan College. And yeah, amazing, eh? And just like when you're working frontline, when you're a faculty member, you need to find like-minded people that support the values of your profession. So Julie is one of those people for me. So thank you so much. Yes, give her a clap. Thank you. So, we started with saying hello. It's really important to say hello. And then it's really important to create safety to be able to tell stories. And I think in the many workshops, that's been happening, and that's what we've heard back from all of you. So we appreciate the vulnerability that people have shared in talking about the challenges in their jobs, in their work life, in balancing personal with professional, in our frustration of, you know, things that are happening around us. But as Eric said, we can't get stuck in the here. We have to look at where are we going forward. So again, I'm going to engage you to say, is there one or two words that you're walking away with from this conference that is inspiring you about our profession? What do we need to do to move forward? So all of the things that you're talking about are interesting that they're not new. So I apologize for not being able to pull this right out. I have to just look for a second because I flipped all over. I'm just going to do it from memory. Okay. So in 1929, when the government created a royal commission to look at that boys' school, which is probably about 4 blocks east of us and 3 blocks north of us, the issues were boys are coming to the program and we have no paperwork on them. We don't have a full history. We're putting kids together with all sorts of issues without being intentional and mindful about what are their needs and who is best to meet their needs. We're not checking up to make sure staff are doing what they say they're supposed to be doing. We're not coming up with treatment plans that we follow through on and evaluate to make sure what our intention is happening. and we're not listening to the children that are with us. Okay, that was 1929, and the same issues are here today. So we can get stuck in being angry about that, or we can get hopeful about what can I do. And I said last night, and I say it as often as I can, it only takes one person to help you tie your shoes. But that one person can change your life. And that's what each of you are doing every day when you go out and work with a youth. And it can be just from a smile or a comment. And I'll tell you one more story before I close. And that is, I had a foster son for 15 years who had a horrific neglect and abuse history. And about 3 years after he'd moved in with us, I was waiting in the van for him like I had many, many times before, taking him to hockey practice at some ungodly hour. Thinking, why did we think this was a good idea when we're exhausted? And he came bounding out of the house and then stood on the porch and looked at me and said, and stopped cold. And when he got in the car, I was like, buddy, what's up? And he was like, you were smiling at me. And I said, yeah. And he goes, you smile all the time, you know? And I'm thinking, oh, that's good. And he goes, and that reminded me of that what happened just before my dad beat me. So every time people smile at me, I wonder what's coming. And now I know it's going to be okay because I've had 3 years of smiles. So that story kind of reminds me that sometimes we have to do things over and over and over and over and over again to feel like we're making a difference. And we have to check in with kids to find out if what we're doing is actually doing what we hope it's doing and have to adjust. But all of that comes with reciprocal relational practice. And that's what makes us different than every other profession. And I'm privileged to be part of it. So thank you.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.